So again, our class has been this class here in the beginning, the theology of Genesis and John. We are going to get to John eventually, but right now we're going to wrap up Genesis hopefully today. We've been studying that redemption is the story of the Bible. You see this every single class because again, this is the great argument of the class. Redemption is the story of the Bible. It's also the story of the book of Genesis. And there you can see the breakdown of Genesis. God's ordering on one side, God's ordering goodness in himself into this world, relentless pursuer of ordering that which is good. On the other side, we see the family's disorder, Abraham's family, but also as a picture of the greater world's disorder as well. And again, God brings order out of disorder. He buys back and redeems the creation that he lost. And again, the breakdown of Genesis. So, there we go. Five beautiful smiley faces there. Five beautiful sections. Finish. And now we're on to the last section today, 37 through 50. The last section of the book of Genesis. The last section we talked about was, of course, Jacob and Rachel. And, of course, and others. Because there's a lot of others mixed in there as well. We saw Jacob's dream, we saw the more betrayal, and then finally Jacob's new name. So just kind of look at that a little bit. We saw Jacob, of course, deceiving his father. Because he deceived his father, he got on the bad side of Esau, because of course he stole Esau's promise. And so Esau says, I'm going to kill Jacob. So Jacob starts fleeing, he starts going west, and he goes to Laban's family. But on the way, he has this spiritual experience where he has the dream of Jacob's ladder and the spiritual experience that he underwent. Finally gets to Laban's house. And of course, Laban's house is deceived. Works 7 years for Rachel, but it's actually Leah. Works 7 more years for Rachel. And he has that whole 20-year time period with Laban. And then Jacob, as we saw last week, starts to say, I need to head back. Go back to the land of my fathers. Go back to the new land of my fathers in Canaan. And so he starts to head back. And so Jacob has another spiritual experience on the way back. As we see Jacob wrestling with God. And Jacob is actually injured. God actually injures him and dislocates his hip. So Jacob, for the rest of his life, walks around with a limp. And we talked about how strength comes through weakness. This picture here. The strength comes through weakness as Jacob wrestles around with God. This also leads then, eventually, as Jacob gets to Bethel, it leads to a name change. Jacob's name will no longer be called Jacob, the great deceiver. And so now Jacob's going to be called Israel, the one who wrestles with God. And the one who wrestles and fights for God as well. As that's, of course, the name Israel actually means. We also saw when Jacob and Esau come back together, the very thing that Jacob feared. If I go back east, how is Esau going to treat me? Of course, on the way back east, he has to do it first with Laban. But that situation is reconciled as God intervenes in that situation. But then he has to face his real enemy, the real question, which is Esau. And of course, Esau comes and kisses Jacob and loves Jacob. So after 20 years, we've seen tremendous progress both in Jacob's life and also in Esau's life. As finally we see that reconciliation between these two brothers. As then they go out and they actually bury their father, Isaac, together. So that brings the arc of Jacob to an end. He's still alive. He still plays a role in this story that we're talking about today. But plays a rather minor role. The one that plays the major role now is the story of Joseph. And that is the last 14 chapters of the book of Genesis. Actually, it's 13 chapters because one chapter is devoted to something else. We'll talk about that very, very briefly. But it's primarily 13 chapters on Joseph. And we talked about the end last week. Why is it Joseph? It's Joseph because he is the firstborn son of Jacob and Rachel. There's 10 other sons before him. But that's Jacob and other wives. This is Jacob and the wife that he truly love, who he was truly Saul and was betrothed to, and that's, of course, Rachel. And so Joseph is the firstborn son, and Joseph is the one that really carries on the story And he gets 13 chapters. And it's the same story we saw with Abraham and that we saw with Jacob. It's a story about formation. Forming the disciple of Almighty God. And of course that means he had to go through the fire of trial and tribulation. And Joseph would definitely go through the fire of trial and tribulation. So let's first of all go through the story. And what we're going to do this morning is just kind of tell the story. Not necessarily by chapter, but just kind of tell the story. And it's a very interesting narrative, in which, again, I highly recommend it to you to go and read it for yourself. There's a lot more intimate detail in there that we're not going to necessarily go over today. But we'll highlight some things that I think are really important theologically, which will eventually get us to our end, the end of Genesis, which gives us the real statement that we'll come back to, that we actually went over our very first class period altogether. But it's going to show up again at the end of this class today, or maybe at the beginning of class next Sunday, depending upon time. So first of all, the setup. We know that Joseph is, of course, the 11th son to Jacob. And we also know, as we've well established in this family, that favoritism is a huge part of this family. Favoritism. It is the very cancer within this family system. We saw the favoritism, first of all, I think, with Sarah and Hagar, all the way back, the first generation. We had these two women, and you had two sons, Ishmael and Isaac, competing back and forth for the father's attention, even though they were 13 years apart. We saw then in the second generation, where Isaac loved Esau, and Rebekah loved Jacob. And there was tremendous tension between Jacob and Esau, partly because of what their parents caused, the favoritism that existed there. And then, of course, we see Jacob doing the exact same thing, the same generational sin, as Jacob loves, obviously, Rachel and the children born to Rachel more than he loves his other children. And we saw that last week, by the way, when Esau's a-coming, what does Jacob do? He lines up his family in three different lines, with the maids and the kids that were born to the maids in front. The second line was Leah and those kids. And of course, behind is, of course, Rachel and Joseph. Which again tells you all the things you need to know about Jacob as a father. He might have been a great father in many, many ways, but he failed in this respect, that he was a father that showed favoritism toward his kids. And that favoritism continues. Obviously, it's Joseph, who is the favored one, much more than the other 10 sons. So the perception is also, though, that we get here is that Joseph also at the same time, being now 17 years of age, he flaunts his favor, kind of like what Sarah was saying about Hagar. Hagar always flaunts it in front of me, that she can have kids and I can't have kids. She's a flaunter. Well, kind of sounds like Curb Your Enthusiasm, I think. A flaunter. Well, Joseph is apparently a flaunter as well. He flaunts his privilege. And envy is, of course, the result. These brothers have to live day in, day out with Joseph being the favored one. Joseph being the one who flaunts his privilege. And so one thing about Joseph, too, is that Joseph also had this tendency that he loved to report back to his daddy whenever his brothers did something wrong. Now, this is the ordinary thing in families, of course. Which kids get rather upset with each other. But Joseph did this apparently to the extreme. Because again, the 10 sons, his 10 brothers, do a lot of bad things. And so he reports back to his father continually. So Joseph is like daddy's little errand boy. Also, we see that fashion comes into the Bible. Fashion for the first time comes into the Bible. Clothes are, of course, a mere necessity. Clothes, of course, cover up the nakedness of the human body. And again, we go back to Adam and Eve and the shame that comes with nakedness. So clothes are a utility, but not here. Because Jacob gifts his son Joseph with this coat, what we call the coat of many colors. This coat that was very multicolored and very, very fashionable. And again, it was very, very loud in a room, obviously. So it's a great symbol here to all the other sons, the great symbol of daddy's affection. Daddy loves him more than he loves me. Just look at what he's wearing. And just look at how much money he spent on that coat. That's a great symbol, though, of envy. And the envy starts to build and build and build even more. And then one more thing about Joseph. Joseph is also a dreamer. That dreams in this day and age were a means of revelation from the gods of this day. And so if you had an ability to not only have dreams, but also have an ability to interpret dreams, and your interpretations come true. So in other words, it's kind of like a prophecy. You really are a prophet because you can hear, you have dreams yourself, or you can hear dreams and you can interpret. That's what this dream actually means. And you turn out to be correct. Then you have an insight into the gods. And if you have an insight into the gods, you have something that can really put you in places of high esteem and of high power in this world. Well, the one true God, as Christians, we say the one true God, not just gods, plural, but the one true God that stands above everything else. This is a God who also uses dreams in order to give his self-revelation, in order to give messages to people. Again, we don't have the full word of God as of yet. Nothing's written down. We don't have the Torah or the law. We have God revealing himself, and he reveals himself partly through dreams. And dreams is a means of revelation. But Joseph has an ability to be able to interpret dreams. He has dreams, and he also has an ability to interpret those dreams. And so Joseph, of course, has a dream that he proudly lets his brothers know about. Again, he's a 17-year-old immature kid. That's who Joseph is at this point. He lets his brothers know about how he had a dream, and this dream, the particulars are there in the text. But the dream basically comes down to that you brothers, all 10 of you, are going to one day serve me. Now, this does not go over very well in the room, because the brothers are strong and of great strength, and here's this little measly 17-year-old kid, and we can punk you any day we want to. We can take care of you anytime we want to. We are stronger than you, and yet you're telling us that one day we will serve you. A little bit of an insult. But Joseph doesn't, I don't think, actually sometimes understand about reading a room and doing things a little more politically savvy. He just kind of is out there with his views and opinions, as kind of annoying little brothers can be sometimes. I was the baby of my family, so, you know, there you go. And Joseph's the baby right now. Well, he's got a little baby, Benjamin here, but for the most part, he's the baby brother. He kind of lords his ability over his brothers. So all that, of course, comes down then to one day. That one day. That one day, which is basically the source of an ordinary day, Daddy Jacob sends his 10 sons out of the field to work. Again, Joseph, the 11th son, the favored one, is going to stay home. Remember that Jacob was the tent dweller, and he was the one that stayed home while Esau went out and worked. Now Joseph is the one staying at home while the 10 brothers go out and work. And they have to sweat out in the field and bring back the family food and things of this nature. So they're supposed to go out and actually pasturing a certain field. Of course, these 10 sons do whatever they want to do, and so they're actually in the wrong place. They actually go to another location. Jacob, of course, by knowing that his sons are continually messing up, says to Joseph, I want you to go and check on them. So do what you normally do, Joseph, go be daddy's errand boy and go check on the sons. Sure enough, Joseph goes to the place they're supposed to be. They're not there. So he gets a messenger and says, no, the 10 sons went over here to this field. So there goes Joseph, and he goes trying to find out where the brothers are at. And so sure enough, the brothers are out there. I don't know what they're doing. They're not probably working. They're probably just doing whatever they want to do. And then, of course, they see Joseph coming from a great distance, afar off, as the Bible says. And as they see Joseph coming from afar off, they know, again, they're going to get in trouble. Because Joseph is the great daddy Aaron boy. Joseph is going to tell daddy what's going on. And we've been caught. But finally the brothers are like, as Joseph is still a great distance away, they finally resolve and say, let's actually do something about this problem. We are sick and we are tired of Joseph. And there he comes flaunting with that coat of many colors, that great symbol of daddy's love and affection. And we're actually going to deal with Joseph today. This is what we're going to deal with. And the brothers quickly say, we're going to go ahead and kill him. Just like Cain and Abel, the envy, getting so much that now we're going to, it leads to murder. We're going to kill him. But of course, as Joseph is getting closer and closer, they feel pretty good about the resolution to kill him. And so Joseph comes, and of course they probably rough him up some, and they take off that coat of many colors, and they throw him in the pit. But then it's one brother that says, it's actually Judah. And Judah says, I'm not so sure if we should kill him, because you see, we don't get much profit off of that. We can actually profit off of Joseph's demise if we sell him. Because you see, these traders come up and down this road every single day. These traders from Midian, Midianite traders. And if we just give Joseph to these Midianite traders and give him as a slave to them, we can actually get profit back from it. That's a much better way to go about it. And so the brothers actually said, yeah, that sounds like a pretty good idea. And so that's what they end up doing. They take Joseph and they sell him to these Midianite traders. And there goes Joseph. They take the coat of many colors because they have to cover up their sin. And so they, of course, they get an animal and they get the blood off the animal and they smear it all over that coat of many colors. They take it home to daddy and they show Jacob and they say, something horrible has happened. On our way back from our field, we see Joseph's body lying there and it's just ripped to shreds. You don't want to see that. But here's evidence of this, of your son's demise. And Jacob is, of course, heartbroken that his son, his firstborn son, to the woman that he loved, is now dead. Joseph, on his end of things, is now goes from these Midianite traders. Eventually, they sell him off to these traders that are heading down to Egypt. And there goes Jacob outside of the land of his fathers, outside of Canaan, being sold into slavery, into a very uncertain future. Most slaves in this day and age, obviously, you know, eventually or work so hard they eventually die. So this is about slave labor, and this is about death. And that's kind of where the first chapter ends. And then the second chapter, that chapter we said is not really about Joseph, is chapter 38. And it's all about Judah and Tamar. And the chapter really exists, and you can read through it, but it basically exists to kind of show, again, Judah being sort of some of the head of this family, if you will. It compares Judah to Joseph. But we're eventually going to get to Joseph. That Judah is a man of sexual disorder. He's a man of sexual disorder and a man who is really the epitome that stands as a symbol of these other 10 sons. These 10 sons are disordered and they're evil. If we haven't already picked that up in selling their own brother into slavery. But of course, it juxtaposes against Joseph, who's going to be shown as a person of great sexual integrity and great integrity overall. Because what happens next is that Joseph actually lands in an okay spot. He lands in the house of Potiphar. And Potiphar here is the captain of the guard for Pharaoh, a very high and important position in Pharaoh's command. And Joseph, of course, works in that household. And again, everything that Joseph touches prospers. So that's one of the points that's here in the story. Everything that Joseph touches prospers. And so therefore, he's able in a very short period of time work his way up. And he's put in the house, the head of the household for Potiphar. And he commands basically everything that's in there in Potiphar's house. But of course, he runs into a problem because it's Potiphar's wife who sees Joseph being a young man and a very attractive and handsome person who says, this is what I want. I get what I want in my life. I'm a very privileged person. And this is what I want, is I want Joseph. And so she comes on to Joseph and comes on many, many times. And Joseph continues to kind of says, no, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to betray Potiphar. Potiphar has given me so much. I'm going to stay loyal, even though I'm a slave. I'm going to stay loyal to him. And I'm going to have integrity. And obviously, implied here is integrity to my God as well. He resists time and time again. Potiphar's wife, though, is insistent. And then one day what happens is that she knows her husband's coming home very, very shortly. And so she comes on to Joseph. She gets him into sort of a tussle, takes a piece of his clothing, and then Joseph is just out of there and runs out of the house and flees temptation and gets out. But now she has a piece of his clothing. And so when her husband comes home, she shows the piece of clothing and says, "This is evidence of what your slave has done. He attacked me." And so there, of course, goes Joseph, the man who worked his way up, but now he's being placed in a dungeon, being placed in prison. This, of course, is Joseph, a slave who has no rights in this day and age. And so obviously, the wife is going to be believed over any slave any day of the week. So here we see Joseph being sold into slavery, working his way up, thinking life is getting better now, and then all of a sudden, because of nothing he's done, he's then banished down to the prison, to the dungeon. A situation far removed from Joseph is that Pharaoh, the king of all Egypt, is upset with two of his workers, upset with his baker and his cupbearer. This baker and his cupbearer ends up in jail, in prison, in the same dungeon that Joseph is in. And so this baker and this cupbearer come one day, and Joseph, of course, has now worked his way up, and he's sort of the head of the prison, right? Because again, everything he touches prospers, and he's able to handle real responsibility. He sees the baker and the cupbearer unhappy one day, and he says, "Well, why are you so unhappy?" They said, "Well, we had a dream last night, and we have no idea what it actually means." And Joseph says, "Well, I'm actually pretty talented at this, so tell me the details of your dream." They tell the equal, each of them tell the details of the dream. And Joseph says, "The point of this dream here is that you, cupbearer, in 3 days, you're going to be restored. Pharaoh's going to like you again and restore you back to your position. But you, baker, you're going to be cut off. It's going to be for you in 3 days. Because Pharaoh's going to hold this big banquet, this big old party, and the cupbearer's restored. But you, baker, I'm so sorry, you're going to be cut off." And 3 days later, those prophecies come true. Pharaoh holds the big party, and of course the baker's cut off, but the cupbearer's restored back. But Joseph says to the cupbearer, "When you're restored in 3 days, I just want you to do me a favor. Please remember me." And that's the word there. It's in the text. Remember me. Because you see, here's the idea. I am in jail. I'm in this dungeon. I am in death. I'm in the midst of this trial, this tribulation. I am in suffering. I am in death. Please remember me. Which becomes, of course, in the Old Testament, one of the great pleas to Almighty God. When I go down to Sheol, when I go down to death, please remember me. And that becomes one of the big abiding questions. Is this God powerful enough or willing enough to remember us even in death, even in trial and tribulation? And Joseph is struggling here. Did God just really kind of wipe me off? So now I'm just being forgotten. Does my life even have meaning any longer? Please remember me. And we know what happens. The cupbearer gets restored. He's back in Pharaoh's good graces. And what's implied here is that the cupbearer has this very convenient memory. He's not going to ask too much of Pharaoh at this point. Pharaoh likes him, lets us go with it. And life just kind of moves on. And the cupbearer does not remember some slave in jail, even though, again, he was the one that really helped him. But then again, then many years pass. And now it's Pharaoh who has the dream. The great king of Egypt, he has the dream, and he is beside himself. He brings in all of his wise teachers to pontificate what this dream actually means, and none of his wise teachers can tell him. And Pharaoh is getting pretty upset. And there's a lot of pressure, as we all know, with presidents and kings and the rest, when there's pressure, when they're frustrated, the people around them better get some answers pretty darn quick. So now it's convenient for the cupbearer to remember something. There's this slave that's there in the prison, still there, and he has this ability. And so he brings Joseph before Pharaoh, and Pharaoh tells Joseph the details of the dream. And Joseph tells Pharaoh, here's what this dream means. There's going to be 7 years of prosperity in the land of Egypt, followed by 7 years of very severe famine. So he doesn't just give him an interpretation, but then Joseph kind of goes on to give him sort of a wise policy. There's, I think, a little bit of that 17-year-old still in Joseph. When Joseph doesn't quite know when to stop, he just then keeps going to Pharaoh and actually starts telling Pharaoh what he should do about the interpretation of this dream. 7 years of prosperity, 7 years of famine. So Joseph says, you need to appoint someone who's wise, someone who can lead this whole policy for you, because you need to get ready. You need to appoint overseers to be in charge of the land of Egypt. You need to tax the people. Start now. Tax the people 20%. One-fifth of all their prosperity, because they're going to have lots of prosperity in these 7 years. Tax them 20% to get ready for the other 7 years. Use all that money and buy grain. Just keep buying it. Keep buying as much of grain as you possibly can and store it up in these 7 years. Because guess what? Well, he kind of says this later, but he says, because he's telling Pharaoh, guess what? The world is coming to Egypt. You're going to be on the front lines. If you prepare and you actually enact this policy, the world will come to you. And again, to any sort of king or pharaoh, this probably also means, more power for me. So it's both those things. We can be a great charity for the rest of the world and provide a need, but Egypt can also become increasingly more powerful as a result of this policy. And Pharaoh knows by listening to Joseph, he's found his man. You, Joseph, are going to be the new prime minister of Egypt. You, Joseph, are going to be the one that will run this policy for me, because you are wise. In fact, Pharaoh says that, Joseph, you will have a divine spirit within you. Now, Pharaoh understands. He knows. He remembers. Again, I'm not this actual Pharaoh. Might have been his father. But he remembers when Abraham came down to Egypt. Remember, and they've heard the stories about this Abraham and this Isaac and this Jacob and the God that is with this family, this power that's with this family. And the one thing these people know in this day and age is you don't mess around with the gods. If you have a God that's proven himself, you keep going with it. You don't want to offend that God. And he knows that Joseph, being part of this family, being what we might call a Jew, part of Israel at this point, he knows he has an insight into this God. And so he tells Joseph, you have a divine spirit within you, and you're the one that's going to run this policy. And Joseph, at 30 years of age, 13 years since he left his land, becomes the second most powerful person in all the country of Egypt. So now it's him as the prime minister. So that one day, of course, he's sold into slavery. So I'm catching up on my slides. Now it's not going to work. Powerful's house. And then, of course, in the dungeon. And now in power as the prime minister. Of course, now the famine's come, and the famine is very, very severe. And all the world does come to Egypt because the world's hungry and they need aid, including those, by the way, in Canaan. So guess what? Jacob gets the sons together and says, we have problems. We have real issues here, and we need you to go out and find food. And we've heard about it. I've read the newspaper. I've Googled this. What they're doing right now in Egypt is pretty revolutionary. So let's go down to Egypt and let's get some food. We have the money. Let's go and buy the food. And so sure enough, those 10 sons get together. And there's a huge caravan that heads down to Egypt. And of course, these 10 sons want a meeting with this man who is, again, doing revolutionary work down in Egypt with this great policy. And so sure enough, they get an audience with this man. And so they stand in front of Joseph for the very first time. They don't recognize him, but he recognizes them. Of course, to them, Joseph is dead and gone. Somebody who's sold into slavery is somebody who, let's just face it, is probably going to die pretty soon. He's got to be dead. But Joseph recognizes them, but they don't recognize him. And the first thing Joseph does is he accuses the 10 sons of being spies. You guys are spies, and I can't trust you. And of course, they're like, no, we're not spies. We really are generally coming from the land of Canaan. We're coming from our father's Jacob. We're coming to buy grain. We just need food. No, you're spies. You're taking advantage of this policy. So what you need to do is you need to prove it. You guys need to go back to the land of your father, and you need to get that son that you talked about. Because you guys aren't all represented here. There's only 10 of you. There's not Benjamin. You need to go back and you need to get Benjamin and bring him here. And by the way, when you leave, I'm going to keep one of you here with me, which is Simeon. And I'm going to jail Simeon up as collateral that you actually will come back. But if you come back and you bring the youngest son, Benjamin, then I'm going to have proof that you probably aren't spies. Because, of course, Benjamin was the one son that, of course, Jacob doesn't send. We all know why Jacob doesn't send Benjamin. This, of course, going down to Egypt is a dangerous, dangerous mission. And it's okay for those other 10 sons, but it's not okay for Benjamin. Benjamin's the last thing I have from Rachel. Joseph's dead, but at least I have Benjamin. And Benjamin, of course, as we all know, becomes now the favorite child of Jacob. But Joseph says that's not good enough. Prove you're not spies. Go back to your father, get Benjamin, and come back here. And if you do so, then I'll show favor upon you. Implication, of course, being that if you don't come back, I can hunt you down and I can deal with you. So, of course, they pack everything up, and Joseph's men are the ones that are in charge of the packing. They, of course, give lots of grain, because, again, Joseph's going to meet the need that they have. But they also pack, along with the grain, the money that they gave to Joseph to actually buy the grain. So they pack the grain and the money. So, of course, the men are headed back, and they get to the resting place, and they look in their bags, and they see all the grain, but they also see the money. And they're like, oh, my goodness. Who did this? Because now what's going to happen is Joseph's men are going to find out that we not only have the grain, we also have the money. And they're going to come for us, thinking that we stole this money. We took the money. So Joseph here is playing some head games a little bit with his brothers, I think a little bit. They finally get back to Canaan, though. And of course, Jacob mourns. He is very upset. Joseph is gone, and now Simeon's gone too. And now this man, this very powerful man, wants Benjamin as well. I can't give Benjamin up. You guys can't go back. But the famine grows more and more severe. And so now they have a choice. You can stay here in Canaan and die, or you can actually risk it and give Benjamin up and actually go back to Egypt. So Jacob finally says, well, go. You can go, but take presents with you. The same man who, of course, brought presents to Esau. You know, take presents with you. Double the money. But all you need to do is make sure you bring back Benjamin. I cannot lose Benjamin too. So the brothers, of course, then they caravan back to Egypt. And they're back to Egypt now for the second time. And the brothers are, of course, ushered back into Joseph's presence. They still don't know who he is. Fear and anxiety, of course, are gripping them because this is a very, very powerful man. They could end their lives just like that. They all think they're going to die anyhow. And Joseph, of course, sees Benjamin for the very first time, and he starts to weep. And the one great thing about this narrative is to see the emotion that Joseph undergoes. He weeps because he loves his brothers. He loves Benjamin so much. He's been so separated from them for so long, not thinking that he would ever see Benjamin again. Because again, it was just that one day. He's just going off to do his father's bidding, and he never comes back home. And it's funny how life can just change just like that. You get into a car, life changes just like that. And for Joseph, life changed just like that. He hasn't seen Benjamin for all these years. So, of course, they eat a meal together. Of course, Joseph goes out of his way to give Benjamin 5 times the portion of the rest of the brothers, which is kind of a fun little thing, fun little detail. And then, of course, the brothers are set to leave the next morning. Joseph, of course, is going to give them the grain that they need because they actually did part of their deal. But on the way back to Egypt, though, Joseph has another surprise for them because he's planted a silver cup in Benjamin's bag. Again, his men are the ones that are doing the packing. So he takes this silver cup and he puts it in Benjamin's bag. And so the brothers start going and they get to the resting place and they're looking and they finally see in Benjamin's bag the silver cup. And they know, oh my goodness, now we really are in for it. Because his men's going to think that Benjamin actually stole this. The one son that we had to protect. And sure enough, here comes Joseph's men. Joseph's men comes and overtakes them and accuses them of stealing and accuses Benjamin of stealing. So then they have to go back to Egypt, and stand before Joseph. And Joseph says, the one who stole from me, the one who took that silver cup, will become my slave. And to this point now, Judah is just begging. I mean, he's like on his hands and knees begging Joseph. Please, 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 no. The one thing I was supposed to do is to bring Benjamin home to my father. He cannot be your slave. No, no, no. Benjamin's the only one left from Jacob and from Rachel. So what Joseph does here is we can say that Joseph's playing a bunch of head games, which is true. But also what Joseph's doing here is in some ways he's kind of being kind of like a god to these sons. This is kind of like a formation process of their own. He's bringing these brothers to the point of compassion. This is what it feels like to actually care for someone else. Foreign concept to these men. This is what it feels like to feel like something has been ripped away from you. You want to please your father and bring Benjamin home, but now Benjamin forever will be my slave. And it's at this point now when Judah's begging Joseph and all the brothers as well, that one of the most dramatic scenes in all the Bible takes place, where Joseph reveals himself and says to the brothers, I am Joseph. Again, lots of emotion that's there in the narrative as Joseph here is crying and weeping loud that people can hear. But he finally reveals himself that I am Joseph. And of course, as we know, that the family finally moves to Egypt as Joseph is eventually reunited with his father. So Joseph actually, after this great reunification, this reconciliation, when Joseph decides, you know, I'm not going to kill my brothers, I'm reconciled to them, he eventually moves his father and moves the entire family to Egypt, which is how Israel comes to Egypt. And of course, then before Jacob slash Israel dies, he blesses his sons. Now it's not just the firstborn son that is blessed, but now it's all 12 sons that are blessed. And we also see a tight partnership between Egypt and also Abraham's family. The same God who has blessed both. As God says, I will bless those who bless you. And Egypt here is blessing Israel, blessing this people, this family. And so therefore, God also blesses Egypt. But we come to the end here, and this is the part here that we have to kind of look at. Which again is, what is the point of Genesis? What is the point of the story that was just told? And what is the point of all the stories? The four generations, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and now Joseph. What is the point of this whole narrative from Genesis 12 all the way to Genesis 50? And this, of course, is the last really profitable thing that's said. The rest of genealogy and the rest, finishing things up. But this is the last theological statement that is made in Genesis 50:20. This is, of course, Joseph speaking to his brothers. But I think it actually means more than just Joseph speaking to his brothers about his specific situation. Joseph says this, you meant evil unto me, but God meant it for good, in order, for the purpose of, to bring about this present result, which is, of course, we have preserved many people alive. So I think there is both the micro and the macro that's going on here. The micro, of course, is Joseph's experience. Joseph's telling his brothers that you meant something to happen. You meant this evil to happen unto me. You were the author of this. But God doesn't always pay attention to the author's intention. Sometimes God does a lot more through things that take place. So even though the brothers meant evil, God is the one that still ordered the good. And so we're going to think about this as time has expired. We're going to think about this then for the next couple of days. And the next Sunday, we're going to wrap up our study of Genesis by talking more about this verse and how this verse really is, I believe, the key verse, the key interpretive verse of the entire book of Genesis, at least Genesis 12 to 50, and the way that God now acts, and the way that God works in order to bring formation. Because I believe there's something really formative here about this very statement. It's not only Joseph's experience, but it's also the way in which God works in formation. So more on that next Sunday, and then we'll also look forward to our study of the Gospel of John. And we'll kind of start trying to see how these two books start coming together. Thank you so much. God bless you.